Case number 15-3044 et al. United States of America versus Sherry Davis, appellant. Ms. Wright for appellant Andre Davis, Mr. Curlin for appellant Sherry Davis, and Mr. Robbins for the appellee.
May it please the court, Lisa Wright, representing Mr. Andre Davis. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. As to the sufficiency of the evidence at trial established the falsity of only a fraction of the 2012 returns. The government needed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Andre Davis was in on the fraudulent scheme, knew Sherry was filing false returns, and not simply an unwitting participant in what he understood to be a legitimate tax prep business. First, as to his evidence of his knowledge generally, the fact that the EFIN application was filed under his name is alone useless. There's no reason to think that Andre's intent was anything other than to participate in a legitimate business.
Do you draw a distinction between count 1 and count 19 as to what the government must show as to your client's intent?
Well, I think that if they show that he knew that he was assisting in the Jaycox return, I think that's probably sufficient to show.
Assisting? What about the district court's ruling in dismissing count 15? District court said it's not enough that the government simply offered evidence that the person was sitting at the computer, that Title 26, Section whatever it was, 7062A, requires more.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Knowledge of the falsity.
So with count 19, what's your argument about insufficiency?
Well, yeah, I don't think this...
Because you know. I mean, you saw what the government said in its brief as to count 1. Reasonable inferences from the evidence mm-hmm. are sufficient as to conspiracy.
Which we disagree about because the general knowledge, the information they point to, and they don't, if they can't establish that he actually knew about the Jaycox, falsity of the Jaycox.
That's count 19. I thought the government's argument that I was referring to had to do with count 1, conspiracy.
Well, he has to know that he's joining a fraudulent scheme. Mm-hmm. And if there's no evidence that he ever knew of any particular false document, and Jaycox is the only one they claim he does, then they're left with just things that are equally consistent with participation in a legitimate tax prep business, and the jury can be left to only speculate of his state of mind, whether he joined a conspiracy to violate the law or whether he was just participating unwittingly. It's really, that's the question.
Well, he knew the IRS was investigating his mother as of 2011, that it had withdrawn her authorization to file electronically.
I don't think it's too clear what he knew about that. The government relies on the conversation with LaDonna for his knowledge.
Well, then he, or I suppose you would say someone on his behalf, asked for authorization for him to file electronically.
Right.
And so his name was appearing on
right, but that's equally consistent with, it doesn't tell us anything about whether he's witting or unwitting.
So you think the only evidence the government has is mere presence?
Yeah, essentially LaDonna, the LaDonna quote warning, which was nothing other than saying, you know everything else is going on. I don't think it's clear when you're saying that he knew his mother was being investigated. I think that the focus, LaDonna's testimony was that family members were blaming LaDonna and not Sherry and that the problem they were upset about was the taxpayers are getting audited and it's LaDonna's fault. And yes, they know that their records about these returns have been seized, but I don't think it's clear and at all that anyone knows that LaDonna is being charged criminally. Her indictment doesn't come down until, her information isn't filed until September. The government's trying to flip her. So presumably the fact that they're talking to her about criminal charges is a secret at this point. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to think Andre is really being warned of any criminal activity. And if he is, LaDonna said that Sherry kept telling LaDonna that Sherry didn't do anything wrong. Now, LaDonna may have had information otherwise, but she did not tell Andre that. She didn't say, listen, here's what's been going on. She just said, you know, do you want to get involved in light of everything else that's going on?
What's your argument on the knowledge with respect to the tax return count?
That Mr. Jaycox.
Yeah, because yes. There's no doubt that there was a false return filed.
Correct.
And there's testimony that he prepared the return.
Well, there's testimony that a young man prepared the return.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, he didn't identify him as the person. What he said was, you know, he made absolutely clear that he was you know, this was based on the signature.
Well, so, let's just assume, I know your argument about that it might not have been him, yeah. But let's just assume that it was him.
Right.
So there's testimony that there's a false return, that he prepared the return. Then what's your argument as to mens rea?
The testimony wasn't really that he prepared it. So it really does come down to the fact that the signature is on there. And LaDonna, first of all, LaDonna testified that, it's not clear that because, let me skip to what you're asking me. That essentially, even if he is the one that he's talking about preparing the return, Jaycox testified that all he did was initialize and put in, that they both input information. And that LaDonna testified that these logins, these names on the bottom aren't meaningful. So we don't know that at the time, that what happened seems to be that the young man, Andre, is entering data, and then Sherry comes over, and they sign it. It actually says,
Jaycox
made clear.
And finalizes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, finalizes it.
Well, that's a critical word, isn't it, here?
Well, and he actually says, who did you see putting information on the return? It was actually both of them. So we know that Sherry actually entered data onto the return, and that she did so after he had done the initial part of the return. So it is really pure speculation at what point these numbers go on. Mr. Jaycox was never asked, did not ever say that who he discussed these numbers with, who came up with the valuation number. He said Andre did not.
And the jury acquitted her as to this return, right?
It appears that the jury went on the name on the bottom of the return. And we know that that alone cannot be enough. The government's questioning of Mr. Jaycox really left this sort of giant gap regarding which one, Andre, Sherry, or both of them, created or knew of the falsity of the donation. Mm-hmm. Now, they were both charged in count 19, as the court says. And it seems like the government was content to sort of leave that ambiguity. You know, they've charged them both. We kind of got them both sort of ambiguously. We don't know who did it. But I think the government thinks that it's other evidence, you know, the EFIN, the fees, the LaDonna conversation, are somehow enough to, you know, take this allow the jury to resolve this despite this ambiguity and not have to speculate whether he had intent. Now, as to Sherry, that's not whether that's true or not. But as to Andre, it turns out those other things add up to nothing. So all you're left with at the end is this just complete ambiguity, which the government left there. You know, they just didn't even really try to establish which one of them, or Jaycox was unable to say which one of them created these numbers or even knew of these numbers.
Well, he did say that they both went through, that Andre went through everything.
He did say that, but, I mean, when she comes in then and finalizes, I think we know how this works when you're in one of these.
And him, apparently gave it back to him to sign.
Yeah, I think he was unclear who gave it back to him to sign, even.
Doesn't matter. It came back to him after this finalization, and he then signed it.
Jaycox.
Yeah. No.
Andre.
Oh, I don't think that's...
As the preparer, isn't that correct?
Well, I think he said he actually did them, the young man, and then Sherry would go back over them, finalize them. I do remember him sitting down and signing them. And then Sherry and I had a discussion after that. So as far as the record shows, Andre's off the scene. And the way these, you know, tax prep things work, there's like a running total. I mean, we all know how you change any number and instantly the bottom line changes. So it's not as if, the tax-wise person and LaDonna both explained that once your name is on there as the prep, once you're logged in with your preparer ID, unless someone logs you out and changes it to them, it's going in under your name. So there's no reason to infer that the fact that his name is on there means
that Sherry framed him.
No, I don't think she. She framed him.
He sets it up on his name. Well, I think he does. Then she puts in the false information and lets it be filed under his name.
Well, I think, as LaDonna said, that what happens, he did. I'm not saying she framed him. He did do the initial entry. Whether Sherry didn't realize, you know, that it was still under his login or whatever. But the point is, it doesn't tell us one way or the other what information Mr. Davis ever really laid eyes on, and at what point in time this information was put in. I think you know, the government believed that it had this sort of conspiracy evidence against him, so it didn't bother them that there was sort of a complete lack of this just gap as to who created these numbers, who knew about these numbers. Did she, you know, And if he doesn't, he's not the one that's talking to Mr. J. Cox, and she's just giving him the, possibly she said, here, these are the valuation numbers. He doesn't know they're not right, even under that scenario. So there's just, we just don't know what happened. There's a complete gap. And you know, I think we all know that it all comes down to this e-signature, since the timing is unclear. An e-signature alone cannot be enough to have beyond reasonable doubt. If it were, we could all be convicted of things that our coworkers submit under our names. A doctor could, you know, be held responsible for a prescription or any circumstance like that. A judge approving CJA vouchers. I mean, you can think of a million examples in today's world of how signatures. It's not like you can look at a handwritten signature and definitively link it to anyone. I want to talk about the insufficiency as long as the court's interested, but I did want to say also that even if the government did manage to eke out a sufficient case here, I want to look at a couple of closing argument that was so prejudicial. The couple of things I really want to point to are when the government said they basically implied that they knew that Mr. Davis had filed personally inaccurate returns. And there's no evidence of that. It was Sherry that was charged with personal returns. And they're implying that he committed a separate uncharged crime. They said in 4 months, they made a staggering amount of money. It's really only $16,000, which is not illegal. The illegal part is preparing false returns. The illegal part is that they didn't accurately report the gross receipts that they were earning. That's a pretty outrageous statement to make in a closing argument in a case where there's been no evidence and suggestion that Mr. Davis ever filed a personally inaccurate return. And the government does not defend this statement in its brief or even address it. And also I would want to mention the LaDonna conversation I think is grossly misrepresented in the closing argument to make it sound much more sinister and inaccurate. You say, they have her saying, you see the trouble I'm in, you see the criminal charges I'm facing. And that was the point I was making earlier. There's no evidence that anyone knows that LaDonna is facing criminal charges. And also his response that I know what I'm doing is quite a bit more sinister than what he really said, which is just showing faith in his mother's statements. Finally, as to sentencing...
Excuse me. When this closing argument was made, were there transcripts already available on the testimony?
That I don't know. I doubt it. I don't think so. Normally that would not be the case. We normally have to order those, and they're produced in connection with the appeal. As to the sentencing, at a minimum...
Let me just ask you a question about the argument. Now, there was no objection to the initial closing argument, but your client's counsel did join one of co-counsel's objections to the rebuttal.
Yes.
And in Andre's counsel's closing argument, he didn't focus on these things that you are now focusing on. And while he said he was relying largely on co-counsel's closing argument, these points you're making were not addressed by Andre's counsel in his closing argument, and were these points raised in his motion for judgment notwithstanding verdict?
I don't think in quite the way, but he did raise it. He raised a general MJOA.
But he didn't list all these things you have in your brief, for
example. Oh, are you talking about as to the closing argument errors?
Yes.
No. But we're acknowledging that, you know.
I understand, and what I'm getting at is that the district court seemed quite responsive to addressing co-counsel's concerns and gave special instructions to the jury on 3 of the 4 points that co-counsel raised. So this is plain error where none of these things was brought to the district court's attention.
I mean, it is unfortunate that no...
No, but what I'm trying to understand is, given the plain error standard, even if the 3 factors weigh in your favor as to the seriousness of some of the comments during closing argument. The burden is very heavy. And how do you surmount it?
Well, I think we have to show that the error is clear. And it is clear because there's just
apparently it wasn't clear enough to counsel. Well, all right, so I mean, it wasn't clear enough to argue in a motion for
Well, that's judgment. The premise of plain error review is that it was missed.
I understand.
You know, and I don't, if that was what the court may have been asking towards the transcript question about that. But, I mean, all this is a factual statement, so it's not, it's either true or it's false, and if it's false, it's clearly
false. So it
affected
his substantial rights? That's
the standard?
I'm into plain error standard. Error has to be clear. Mm-hmm. It has to affect your client's substantial
yes.
rights.
And the burden is on us on that.
And how do you meet it?
Well, because accusing someone, when the prosecutor is implying that he has information, and frankly, the fact that no one says anything, I mean, it actually makes it more likely that the jury must have thought, well, I guess that must be, boy, he must know something.
I don't think you can benefit from your
yeah.
Well,
failure to object.
Maybe not. But I do think that...
Well, what I'm trying to understand is, mm-hmm. under the three factors that we consider, namely the closeness of the case, the centrality of the issues, and what mitigation was taken to
right.
address the errors. And here all we have is the general instruction about arguments of counsel are not evidence.
That's right.
How would you write this paragraph in the opinion? No, I'm serious about
yeah.
it. I mean, your
well,
brief just
it's,
says it is.
Right. It's central to the issue because it goes to his intent and knowledge. If he's filing his own, if he's not reporting this, that suggests he thinks it's dirty money. And he's also committed another crime, an uncharged crime, and that he and Sherry are comparable and that they're both making this money and not telling the IRS. I mean, it's deadly to any suggestion that he thinks this is a legitimate business if he's not reporting his income from it. So the centrality is clear, and I think the closeness of the case is obviously clear. We don't think they met it at all. And I don't think it's the explosiveness of this allegation, and I mean, Maddox is a little different, but it does talk about when, you know, there's sort of a prosecutor sort of vouching for evidence for which there's just none.
You're focusing on the part about the use of they to intimate that Andre had filed his own false tax returns, not the closing argument characterization of the conversation with LaDonna?
That is also, those two together I think are the worst, and they obviously are cumulative, and I want to not be dropping any of our claims. I mean, the goodwill receipts also is, I think, quite damaging. I mean, I can talk about any of those things, but I was focusing on, I think the most explosive is that the LaDonna conversation, as I said, I think it's really, you know, quite different to say, you see the criminal charges I'm facing. That's what the government's saying. They warned him that there was a crime going on, potentially. If he had known that, I say, leading the jury to think that Andre proceeded, knowing the government thought a crime had been committed by a 2FT preparer, it really tips the scale, as opposed to just thinking, LaDonna has gotten our clients into trouble, and now they're being audited, but mom says it's all going to go away. And saying, I know what I'm doing.
The error that's plain, mm-hmm. in your view, is the district court's failure to intervene at this point?
I think it has been a factual misstatement.
Right. Okay. So the closing argument incorporates a factual misstatement of prior testimony. Neither the district judge nor defense counsel picks that up, but it's plain.
It's plainly incorrect, and I guess I would point the court to...
Well, it is unarguably incorrect.
Right.
The question is whether that would be plain to someone sitting in the courtroom.
Well...
Someone with a great interest in the matter, such as defense counsel, but beyond that, with the district judge. It's not a question of law. We're talking about whether they picked up on a mischaracterization mm-hmm. of testimony offered some days before.
Well, to be honest, I don't think it is unreasonable to think that when... The judge is very familiar with the indictment and understands perfectly well that it's only Sherry's charged with personal returns. So if he heard that, if he caught it, granted it's a quick statement, but anyone that actually heard what the judge said would plainly be like,
well,
what?
That Sherry was the only one charged with that isn't really
But there was no evidence at all.
That's more important, right? It's not that Sherry was the only one charged with it. This could have been uncharged conduct. It's just that the mischaracterization of the prior testimony.
Well, it was creating something for which there was no testimony. I think Judge Hogan was very well paying close attention to what the evidence came in and knew well. Anybody who was in the courtroom would have known that there had been no evidence at all. There was quite a distinction between...
So if he was very much aware of that, what happened?
Well, it's a quick statement. That's all I can say. It's a quick statement. We don't know why the people in the courtroom, other than the participants, didn't say anything.
When you say something's plain error, you're asking us now and going forward to hold the district judge to that standard of acuity.
Well, I think it's an unusual case. Most cases are not close like this. Most misstatements aren't explosive like this. I mean, this is really an unusual situation, and it's also combined with all these other problems as well. This clear, the altering, it's really a shifting towards a much more sinister interpretation of LaDonna, suggesting that Andre is involved in copying receipts is really just devastating, because otherwise there's zero evidence that he has anything to do with receipts, valuations, donation numbers, any false anything. And to have his hands on these receipts that are being given out is devastating.
All right. Did you want to finish up your argument?
Well, I just wanted to say about the sentencing. I'm not going to go into detail, but I just wanted to say that it's at a minimum he's entitled to a remand for resentencing at a loss in restitution, and the number we would say is $21,287, which eliminates the three items of loss that defense counsel clearly objected to. One, and the most egregious, was the loss from Sherry's personal tax returns, which he was not charged with and were not part of the conspiracy. And this other two were the Thomas Williams and Deborah Johnson losses, which were based on this unexplained preparer pattern, which no one ever explained, and the judge had concerns about. The critical thing was Agent Naeem said that we took the amount that was the inflated amount and we gave them credit for any actual donation. And the problem is, as to those two taxpayers, we don't know what the size of the donation was. And so,
all right. And your last argument is. That's your last argument.
Right. Just to be super clear about the conspiracy, if there's no evidence of count 19, if count 19 is insufficient, then there's just absolutely no evidence of conspiracy, because that's the only count that charges him with any knowledge of any falsity at all. So
all
the conspiracy falls with it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Always a challenge. Can I move this up? Good morning, members of the court. Adam Kurland representing Sherry Davis. I'm going to focus my elaboration points mostly on the Brady issue, but of course, if I have time, I'll deal with a variety of other issues as well, including the mistrial issue. The starting point with respect to the Brady issue, a couple things are clear. Sherry's not raising a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And obviously, we don't have to meet that standard in prevailing on the Brady claim. The real issue is the third, the prejudice prong. And as this court said in Pasha, as reflected in the variety of the post-Brady Supreme Court cases, the focus is, would an objective fact finder who had not previously determined guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which means essentially ruling out the district judge, is there sufficient issues with respect to the untimely disclosure or the non-disclosure to raise a question that really raises significant issues that undermines the confidence in the verdict? And in this particular case, the answer is clearly yes in four critical respects, three of which the district judge got totally wrong, and this court has the opportunity under de novo review to reevaluate that. The first point is that the issue with respect to the Brady nondisclosure has to do with evidence that concerns the government star witness. There is no doubt that the government, no matter how strong they think the other evidence is, without LaDonna's testimony. Without her cooperation, this case is not brought, or at least it's not brought in any way with respect to how it was actually indicted. And I don't think there's no question about that. The government, both I believe in some post-trial motions for judgment of acquittal and the mid-trial motion for judgment of acquittal, emphasizes that when the court asks what's the evidence of the conspiracy, the main focus is on LaDonna's testimony and LaDonna's involvement. So I don't think there's any question about that. Now, the other three are wrong. The evidence that was at issue with respect to the Brady nondisclosure was critical evidence that was both new impeachment evidence in an entirely new avenue that was not heretofore brought up, and that is that the Brady statement was the acknowledgement that LaDonna knew that when she filed her 2006 to 2010 returns, she knew that she was preparing a false return with false dependents. That is different from the earlier statement that had been provided that said that the Brady statement, she says that sort of somewhat ambiguously, she says that Sherry prepared the first one, she prepared all the other ones. That's coupled with her express acknowledgement that she knew the information was false. Her earlier statement that had been turned over in discovery was that she herself personally had prepared her 2006 or 2010 returns, and they were accurate. This line of question concerning dependence, so at minimum, when the Brady information is finally disclosed after trial, there's now a whole new inconsistent statement that didn't exist before. So this entire line of questioning with respect to when LaDonna was on the stand, both on direct and on cross, is not brought up because there's no reason to. It's a fraud theory or falsehoods that aren't charged in the indictment, and there's no inconsistent statement yet. So the new information provides an additional avenue of substantial impeachment on an avenue that had not been pursued before, and it is, so that's number one with respect to impeachment. Number two, and this kind of dovetails because this is not exactly, but it's the same thing that happened in Pasha under different facts, and that is that the argument was made at the trial court, and we make it in our brief, that the evidence was also substantive evidence that could have been admitted at trial had that statement been prepared, that LaDonna was the one who actually filed her 2006 return by herself. She had earlier stated that one time. And that then sets up the entirely different argument that was clearly preserved in the record and timely raised, that she had the knowledge to cook up her own independent tax fraud scheme. That point, the judge totally sort of poo-paws is just merely cumulative. On the other point with respect, the impeachment is merely cumulative. On the substantive issue, the judge says, well, it's highly unlikely that she would testify, because that's the other argument, the third thing the judge got wrong, that Sherry's lawyers argued that had we had this information, we would have pursued LaDonna more aggressively, we'd have gotten it admitted into evidence as substantive evidence, not just new impeachment. It's major stuff. And on top of that, that it would have come in such a manner that would have also opened up the opportunity for Sherry to testify. Now, the judge
line of argument, sure. it's that had you been aware that LaDonna had falsified her own tax returns, then it would have set up a potential substantive defense to the effect that it wasn't Sherry, it was LaDonna who was orchestrating things. And then as to that, what do you do with the fact that the jury convicted Sherry on a number of counts after LaDonna left?
All right. Here's the way I looked at that. The first thing, Your Honor, is that, and then I'm just going to read one line out of Pasha with respect to the speculation as to what would have happened. It goes, we never would have known the statement would have been favorable or unfavorable, but because the government that had failed to comply with its Brady obligations, the uncertainty must be charged to the defendant's case. Here's the way that this goes down. Two arguments. The first, Your Honor, is that if the court accepts the fact that this sort of really eroded or undermined the confidence in the verdict with respect to Sherry's credibility and her role in the conspiracy. That knocks out the first half of the conspiracy. Because the, even though the government indicted with the normal language, you know, known and unknown, there is zero evidence in the record that there were any other co-conspirators. And I have the cites if you want me to dig them up with respect to the government arguing specifically that it's Sherry and LaDonna, then it's LaDonna and Andre. I mean, then it's Sherry and Andre. With regard to the arguments that co-counsel has made, the first answer is that if the court reverses for insufficient evidence against Andre, then the second half of the conspiracy charge, not the substantive counts necessarily, but the conspiracy charges fall away under the rule of consistency because they were tried together, and if this court determines as a matter of law that there was insufficient evidence that Andre was involved in the conspiracy, there are not two co-conspirators anymore. So that knocks out the entire conspiracy charge.
So your argument depends on our...
Your Honor, no, that's the first part. The second part is, and I would say that even if... Well, that's clearly, if you knock out Andre, that follows.
Right, but suppose we don't. So do you have an independent argument?
Yeah, sure. Even if you don't rule on the insufficiency argument with respect to Andre, going back to the undermining the confidence in the outcome of the case, this is the government's star witness. This case really isn't as strong as the government claims it is. And consistent with Pasha, and I think it's one of the other cases, Solomon or whatever, it says that the spillover, you don't necessarily apply the spillover, but you can under the circumstances. This is a complicated, it's not the most super complex conspiracy charge that any of us have ever seen. I acknowledge that. But it's intricate in some ways, and it focuses heavily on the credibility of LaDonna and the fact that if they now would have this information, again, I don't have to establish it beyond a reasonable doubt, but it raises it, it erodes the confidence in the verdict that maybe the jury would have think, and it's logical to think, that wait a minute, Sherry gets up there now and testifies, and that's their fault because they were the ones that caused the speculative problem, that it undermines everything that has happened. If there's evidence now, substantive evidence in the record that that LaDonna has the wherewithal to create her own fraud scheme, that sort of undermines her killer as holding up the whole case. So I think that the confidence in the verdict is so eroded with respect to her credibility, even with respect to the counts that come after she leaves the conspiracy. And Judge Srinivasan, the other thing that I want to emphasize with regard to the weakness of the case that goes to the prejudice, there are three things that are really going on with this case. Now, I know that Judge Rogers went through it, you know, how specific it is as to some counts, the involvement, and I recognize that this is not a super weak case against Sherry, but nor is it as strong as the government suggests. The strongest evidence of that, Your Honor, is that the way they argued this case throughout the trial was that Sherry and Andre were guilty, and they were very problematic, is a charitable term to use concerning how they tried to deal with the taxpayers. Their position before the jury was that the taxpayers were not culpable, that it's okay to sign stuff under penalty of perjury if you're not reading it. They didn't even want to give the taxpayers immunity. It was a big fight. If you recall the transcripts there, Judge Hogan had to basically tell them, if these guys are going to assert the Fifth Amendment rights, they're not going to testify unless they get formal court-ordered immunity, which happened. So these are not according to the government, non-culpable taxpayers. That's what leads to one of the reasons why they're so powerful with regard to their wrong statement about Andre in closing and their misstatement in the rebuttal. But at the Rule 33 motion, after the jury has done its job and gone home, at the Rule 33 motion, they totally changed their tune. And now they argue that the strength of the case against both defendants is enhanced because the taxpayers are co-conspirators, too, or are criminally culpable, too. Now, that's it. I don't have the site. I mean, I could dig it up, but I'm running out of time. Judge, there's tons of case law, whether it's from Justice Scalia in the entrapment case, whatever. Inconsistent theories show a weakness in the case, and normally that hurts the defendant, who sometimes likes to argue, I didn't do it, or if I did, it was entrapment. But the principle holds with regard to both parties, and their focus on a totally different theory to convince the judge not to rule for a new trial in the post-trial Rule 33 motion, which was totally contrary to how they argued the case before the jury, is the clearest signal from their own, out of their own mouth, that the strength of the case they presented to the jury, start to finish, is weak to some extent. And that funnels into why the confidence of the verdict, if Sherry's credibility is now called into further question, consistent with Pasha and consistent with Brady, Bagley, you know, all those cases.
LaDonna's.
If LaDonna's credibility is called into question in that manner, that to me is a clear extension of Pasha to cover this case throughout the whole thing. Now, what's left also are some additional counts, substantive counts against Sherry. But once you throw out the conspiracy, I won't even go there, obviously, because if you throw out the conspiracy against Andre, then everything has to go. But then the nature of how all of the evidence is evaluated, even the counts, the substantive counts afterward, Sherry, I think, was acquitted of one of those. But in addition to that, you have a situation where Sherry would have been able to testify. That assertion was made at the trial that with this different way of dealing with the case, she would have testified. Pasha says that, again, the uncertainty and the speculation has to be, again, the language is, has to be, that must be, that uncertainty has to be charged to the government. So the court was wrong when the judges said, I find it incredulous that she would have testified. But this is specifically with respect to her individual counts, which should not have been in the indictment at all.
If said it should have been charged, the government should have had a burden on this, right? But if it's not a credible claim, I don't know why you would pursue that.
You mean Judge Ginsburg, not a credible claim that she would have testified?
Yes.
You know, look, the rule of thumb, if you read all the white-collar stuff, is never have the criminal defendant testify because for whatever reason. Okay, and that's probably, for the most part, good sense, and that's generally how it happens most of the time, but not always. And to say that it's not credible is to take it from the point of view of the trial judge.
You come up with a theory as to why this was highly prejudicial, that it altered the way in which the defense was presented significantly, different theory altogether.
Yes.
That theory has to be at least somewhat plausible in order to credit your claim that that's how it would have been argued.
Well, Judge Ginsburg, two things. The main thing would be, or not the main thing, but point one would be that if there's substantive evidence in the record that LaDonna was the, I use the term mastermind in the general sense, the government sort of makes fun of that, but if there's substantive evidence in the record that would have yielded a whole different cross-examination of LaDonna, by the way, that she has the wherewithal to create her own independent fraud schemes.
It would have done that, granted.
Pardon?
It would have done that.
Would have done that. Yeah. In addition to that, there's evidence that again, when Sherry, when the search went down, Sherry is teaching in Las Vegas. LaDonna is sort of bragging to the undercover officer who comes in that she's running the show, whatever, so on and so forth. The implausible nature, again, you can't credit the district judge because the Supreme Court case law with respect to the standard that this court has clearly adopted, that it's the hypothetical fact finder who hasn't already found guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's this court looking at it that it's not so implausible to say this would have, again, raised that totally different defense. And two, at least, let's work backwards, at least with respect to her own counts, with respect to her own tax returns that weren't charged in the conspiracy and should have been severed out. It raises a weird question why they were in there. At minimum, it gives her an opportunity to get up there and testify about those, the four counts concerning her own tax returns, which she was hamstrung from doing now. She's going to take the stand. Now she can address those things. But on the larger thing, you've got these culpable taxpayers who, and the main thing, or one of the big things, are the blank receipts or the white-outed receipts. And I don't want to get my, I don't want the IRS to come after me, but every year we all drop off stuff at the Goodwill, whatever, and 9 times out of 10, or 98 times out of 100, we receive a blank receipt. So it is...
It's not blank. It's itemized. It just doesn't have dollar amounts.
No. Well, no.
If you don't give them an itemized receipt, you're making
a
mistake.
But the goodwill, I don't know what Judge Rogers...
I think we understand your point.
Well, I hope so, because I don't want to go out...
The government's right here.
Handcuffs, though. But... So the fact that filling in of blank receipts is suspicious in some general sense, but it is not. Look, I can't retry the whole case standing right here. But there's enough uncertainty going on, and the focus would have been different to the point where it would have only taken. Again, the standard I need to meet is: does it undermine the confidence that maybe one juror? Again, a couple of the jurors already acquitted on some counts that I'm sure the government was upset about because it seems inconsistent with it. There was no Pinkerton instruction, to my recollection, so they couldn't utilize that. But there's some difficult and inconsistencies going on with respect to the jury's verdict. I think consistent with the case law, consistent with a logical extension of PASHA, that it's not inconceivable under the standard that she might have testified. And she might have also then the erosion of LaDonna's credibility would have had the jury say, look, we can't trust this. And plus you've got all these taxpayers out there who have been given walks under weird circumstances. That has undermined the confidence of everything.
Briefly to switch you to a different subject.
Okay, on the mistrial.
That was not it.
The sentencing?
Yes. Specifically this.
Oh, sure.
What would you, the Seventh Circuit Schroeder case is helpful. What would you have had the government do beyond what it did to determine the amounts that it could attribute to Sherry?
Well, obviously it's their burden. I understand it's by a preponderance, but one that... You need more than just a summary that, at least with respect to some of that, the agent who testified didn't even fully understand what was the nature of what went into preparing the summaries. But the other thing is when the government is going to come up with these enormous calculations, it just seems that the preponderance standard can't simply be, and I understand that the case law says they can use summaries, there's the default 28%, but they made a blanket, essentially, calculation simply based on virtually no evidence. So do they need to call more?
Well, they're making some an inference, right? They send out letters, and as to those from whom they receive no response, they infer that the entire deduction in question was inflated, right? It was fraudulent. Now, what should they have done to get you down below that 550?
Well, they probably need to, again, any time they're going to prove an amount, and I know that the case law supports this, the guidelines support it, that they're not necessarily limited, and they're certainly not limited to only what was provable at trial. I totally understand that. But that inference, I think they need to do more. They at least need to do a selective audit of some of those.
Okay, so some of them responded. And I'm not sure how specifically this is to the record, but assume that some responded and showed that, and invariably it turned out that those who responded had deductions that Sherry or Andre had inflated, okay? Now, the others who don't respond, as to those, is it not a fair inference that the pattern would have been the same?
Judge, I don't think so, because we're still dealing in a criminal case and non-response. I mean, government...
If they can't do that, what should they do?
Well... Then
you're on the verge of a good case here, but I don't know what you're expecting from the government.
They need to do, and I hope this is probably the best answer I can give today. They need to do something more than these essentially carte blanche or totally global inferences that is generally not permitted in any other areas of criminal law, and particularly with respect to this.
So then you'd say they can't count the people who didn't respond.
No, well, listen, the government, if this jacks up sentencing in this case or the guidelines and in a lot of white-collar cases with regard to amount of losses that go enormous, and I'm not going to relitigate the whole point of the unfairness in some general sense of what the government proves at trial beyond reasonable doubt, and then what they mushroom with respect to a higher guidelines calculation, with respect to a much lower standard sentencing. But it seems to me not unfair to tell the government that if they are going to put together one a case, what is proved at the case is proved at the case, and in the chart that we have in our reply brief, even with respect to what was proved beyond a reasonable doubt by actual testimony, I believe there's a I don't know if it's substantial, but there's in some cases a significant difference between the amount of loss claimed and what the actual trial testimony shows. That's nibbling around the edges with respect to just the count.
All right, let's switch then to the D.C. procedure.
Okay.
What's your complaint about what D.C. did?
Well, I just think that they have to do more than what they did, and if people are not going to respond or if they're going to sort of do a carte blanche on saying that we're categorizing everything and taking an estimate, that the government, who has a lot of resources in this regard, just needs to do more. Because otherwise, there is...
Well, the government sat down and interviewed 25 taxpayers, federal government.
That's right.
And they did a lot. They interviewed 25 taxpayers. They wrote an MOI on virtually all of them.
Well, it just seems
D.C.,
that...
D.C., I don't think, interviewed anyone.
No, they did. That's my recollection as well. It just seems that the estimate provisions that are in the guidelines deal with a situation that seems to be like a loss in a fraud case is more ethereal in many respects than loss on a tax return. Because ultimately, I guess this might be it, Judge. If the government wanted to, it would take an enormous amount of time, with respect to each return, because on the four corners of the return, there is in fact a number out there of a specific calculation based on government documents as to what was the inflated amount on a tax return. They're sort of borrowing, I think, too far from the larger category of estimates in fraud cases, which sometimes really cannot be calculated. Like how much did Enron cost people, whatever. That's a large, you can estimate in some sense, but it's incalculable. I think with respect to tax returns, that the court could at least come up with some direction for the district court to come up with some middle ground more than what they did that would be more fair to the defendant.
Well, the extreme would be that they would have to audit each return.
That would be the extreme, Judge.
All right. So what's the middle ground?
Sampling
would be a possibility. Something, though, more than, there are statistical models that I think are just more comprehensive, I think that would be a good term, than what was done here.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Alex Robbins, appearing on behalf of the United States. And at the outset, I'd like to clear up two things that I think might make Professor Kerlin, my colleague, and Judge Ginsburg rest easier. The first is Professor Kerlin is doing nothing wrong by getting blank receipts from Goodwill every year. That is, in fact, the common practice. And the reason that they do that is because it's the duty of the taxpayer, not Goodwill, to report what you donated and the value of what was donated. The reason the Goodwill receipts came up in this case wasn't that there's anything wrong with blank Goodwill receipts. It was that Thomas J. Cox testified that he took Goodwill receipts primarily AmBets receipts from a different organization, He took blank receipts to Sherry Davis's house, and he didn't fill those receipts out.
Right.
So the government's argument was that he wasn't the one making up this $50,000, $45,000 figure for his donations that year. That's the significance of the receipts. To Judge Ginsburg's point about sentencing, I want to clear something up. The issue with the correspondence audits where letters were sent by the tax authority to the taxpayers saying, you know, could you please document these, and they never responded or couldn't document them.
Are you talking about D.C. or federal?
Yes, yes, Judge Srinivasan, that's D.C.
Right.
And we're not relying in this appeal on the D.C. tax laws. We are relying on the federal tax laws, and the federal tax laws gets us to $642,000.
I thought you were relying on both.
Yeah.
I mean, you may be saying that you don't need to rely on both, but I thought you were.
59 in our brief. We're not arguing the correctness of the D.C. tax laws in this case.
So you're fine if we just eliminate D.C. altogether?
Correct, because it keeps us in the same guidelines range. And there's no and the defense argument is exclusively based on the guidelines. So that's footnote 59 in our brief.
So you're still above 550.
It's still above 550, which is the cutoff. It's 550 to 1.5 million under the 2015 guidelines, which I realize is a different issue. But and it's in the same guidelines range. The defense isn't making no, like, 3553A1 or any kind of discretionary argument. It's just a guidelines argument, and so to that extent, it makes no difference. The federal tax laws here wasn't based on correspondence audits. It was based on MOIs. So to the extent that Professor Perlin is looking a memorandum of interview, to the extent that we're looking for a middle ground here between an official IRS audit on one hand and sending out letters to people on the other, we have that in this case.
So when you say MOI, the interview is the one that's conducted by the agent?
Correct. The interviews were conducted by the IRS revenue agent. And
is that name?
25 taxpayers.
Correct. And those are the taxpayers that are listed in the sentencing chart that the government introduced at sentencing. Primarily, it's the people who testified at trial. There are a few additional witnesses, and that's where the $642,000 figure comes from. All of those were based on memorandum of interview where someone from the government sat down with the taxpayer, asked the taxpayer about a return, and the taxpayer said, yeah, these items aren't right. I didn't put those on there. The special agent who testified, as he testified, reviewed all of the memorandum of interview. All of those memorandum of interview were turned over to the defense before the sentencing proceeding. That's where the Brady issue came from, actually. And then, I should say, the only exception to that is Sherry Davis did not have memorandum of interview. She was the defendant, so we relied on our proof of trial for that. So these were based on talking to the taxpayers and having the taxpayers say that this item is false. That's how we got to the federal tax law figure.
What are we to make of the notations regarding some of these entries that they're per DOJ's instructions or, I think in some cases, no MOI?
I think, Your Honor, the per DOJ instructions, well, let me back up. That document was not a document the government relied on in sentencing. It was not a document the special agent who testified had ever seen before. It's not in the record from either side what the document is, other than it was.
This document was submitted by the government with a sentencing memorandum.
It was.
Did it somehow leave the record after that?
What is in the record, and I can tell you where the document actually came from, but I want to make clear that what is in the record from the district court proceedings is that this document was attached inadvertently to a filing at sentencing, and it was not something that the testifying special agent had ever seen.
Well, that became clear. He was unable to defend.
And I think the special agent quite properly, instead of saying he knew something he didn't, answered the question truthfully. He has no idea what these things mean because he's never seen the document before. That's what I would say too. I hope if someone.
Now, when this first came before the district judge, he expressed a great deal of concern with what these notations meant.
Correct.
And so they would need to be explained.
And the government explained them that this was this.
Said, well, here's a clean version of the document that doesn't have these ambiguous notations, right?
Again, for context, what actually happened was this was a draft document prepared well before the trial that the government erroneously attached to its sentencing filing, which is why some of them don't have MOIs and some of them are incomplete, because it was prepared long before trial. I don't think the government said that in front of the district court. What the government said in front of the district court was, this document was erroneously attached. The special agent has never seen it. If you look at the two documents, the tax loss on the real document is lower than the erroneously attached document. And on the real document, all the names there correspond to memoranda of interview that by that point, had been taken and the special agent had read and was able to testify about. So the fact that the special agent had no idea what this draft document was that he had never seen before is, it doesn't in any way undermine the government's evidence of sentencing.
It's completely irrelevant, frankly. The problem is not, or at least not limited to, the inability of Naeem to explain the document. He clearly couldn't do that, not having prepared it or even seen it. It's that the district judge was given, perhaps inadvertently, what is perhaps a penultimate draft that raises questions about the source of some of these numbers, it's particularly those that say based on preparer pattern. I mean, the ones that say based on an MOI, you take them at face value.
Right. The ones that say per DA instructions, I would point out, are LaDonna Davis and Sherry Davis. So it's pretty obvious, I think, just from context, why those say what they did.
Well, I don't know what it means to be based on the preparer pattern.
The ones that said based on preparer pattern, a number of those don't appear in the final document. So those are out. A number of the individuals listed there. That's why the tax loss figure goes down by about $25,000. The other ones had MOIs. There were MOIs prepared for those people. The special agent testified that there were MOIs prepared for those people, that he had read them, and those MOIs were produced to the defense, which is why the defense doesn't allege that there weren't MOIs. What the defense argument is this is confusing, therefore it fails guideline 6A1.3.
So just to be clear, I mean, are you saying that for every one of those, it either wasn't relied on or there was an interview conducted?
Yes.
Everyone.
And those memorandum of interview were produced to the defense, and the special agent testified that he reviewed all the memorandum of interview, and that's what the case. That is what the tax loss figures were based on, which I think is why.
Right, Naeem again, or someone else?
Agent Naeem, special agent Naeem. And he didn't take the interviews. He reviewed them because he had also sat through the trial. So he had sat through the trial. He'd seen the evidence. He'd seen the witnesses testify. He also then reviewed the MOIs, and then sort of, at that point, all the information was in one place. So then he testified at the hearing.
But someone did the interviews.
Correct.
So they're not based on extrapolation.
This is not extrapolation. This is not meta or sampling. This is nothing to do with sampling. And frankly, it has really, this extra document has nothing to do with anything, because there's no dispute, I don't think, that if you take away the draft erroneously filed document, that what the government did here in its sentencing proceeding is completely proper and is, in fact, normal. You talk to taxpayers, you take the evidence from trial, plus any additional taxpayers you can prove by preponderance that these figures were false and knowingly put on the return by Sherry Davis, and that's the tax loss used for sentencing. And that's how the agent got to the $642,000 figure that was the federal tax loss. And then that's what the record reflects. So we don't need to get to correspondence audits or D.C. tax laws or anything else to affirm the sentence in this case.
We have the four or five places in the record where the district judge, faced with the repudiated document, raised questions about it. Is there any place in the record where he explains that those are no longer of concern?
The district judge's ultimate conclusion, I think, not at any length. The district judge's conclusion after hearing both sides of it was, I think the government has adequately set forth the tax loss in excess of $642,000, and then added the D.C. tax loss and assigned the guidelines level that way.
But what you just described and told us, we can find that in the record?
In the sentencing hearing, yes. That is, the sentencing hearing is, as far as I'm aware, the only place in the record where this comes up and is then explained. And again, it's because I don't believe the prosecutors were aware of the erroneously attached document until this was brought up in the sentencing hearing. It all happens relatively fast in terms of what the explanations are and what's happening. But really what happened here is, and I don't mean to say it was improper. I mean, the government had a prima facie case by preponderance of the evidence of a tax loss. The defense found a document kind of resembled the actual document being used that the testifying agent didn't know anything about and created some confusion by asking him questions that he was unable to answer and then left it at that. That they haven't gone any further. That doesn't, as a matter of law, undermine the sentencing proceeding. As a matter of just common sense, it doesn't either, given what this document was. It was just a prior draft.
Can I ask you a different question about sentencing, which is a small amount relative to what we've been talking about? But just Andre's objection to the roughly $4,000 restitutionary award predicated on the false tax returns filed by Sherry?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the government's theory for how Andre can be held responsible for Sherry's own tax returns?
Two theories. First of all, Sherry's own tax returns are part of the charged conspiracy. So even under Huey and the case saying the restitution is generally based on counts of conviction, it's part of the conspiracy.
And you're basing that on the way the indictment's framed?
On the way the indictment's framed.
Assume I don't agree with you on that.
Then second argument would be under the MVRA, the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, 3663A, I think, that we cite in our brief, when you're dealing with a crime that's a scheme or pattern or conspiracy, restitution is not limited to the offense of conviction. In other words, when you're dealing with a...
It has to be limited in some way.
It's
can't
limited.
Be
it's essentially relevant conduct. So normally restitution is more limited than relevant conduct. You can get relevant conduct for, say in a case like this, for all kinds of additional false returns that weren't charged. You can't get restitution for those. You don't get restitution for the offenses of conviction. After the Supreme Court's decision in Huey, Congress amended the restitution statute to allow for restitution beyond the offense of conviction in cases involving scheme, pattern,
right,
or conspiracy.
But I guess there has to be some nexus. There has to be some nexus to something that Andre did.
Oh, absolutely. He was working for a criminal enterprise. He was part of the conspiracy because he's working for a tax preparation business that files almost exclusively false returns. That's what they did. The testimony, it wasn't just LaDon Davis. Dwendolyn Hart Walk also worked there and testified that the job of what Sherry's tax return preparation business did was take people who had withholding and get all of their withholding back.
So if he's part of a common scheme for a month, and then Sherry files a false tax return that he has no idea about that's for $10 million, has nothing to do with him at all in terms of his own conduct and knowledge, then he can be hit with a restitutionary award for the $10 million?
So like a temporal argument that I don't believe the defense has made that argument. I think the temporal argument that he's only on the hook for the loss for when he was part of the conspiracy, in this case it doesn't matter because the $4,000 reflects the Sherry's unreported receipts for the time period when Andre was part of the conspiracy.
The temporal overlap is just maybe the easiest way to exhibit what seems to be a pretty breathtaking scope of causation that's asserted by the government, which is that if one defendant just has nothing to do with part of another defendant's conduct, even though they're both concededly involved in some joint enterprise, has nothing to do with that at all, as a matter of restitution, Defendant A can be responsible for something that was based on the conduct independently of Defendant B. Hmm.
I think that the nexus is closer than the premise of your question suggests, because first of all, we do have temporal overlap, so that part's clear. It's not like this is it's a drug case, for example, where a lower level person in the drug gang is on the hook for the unpaid income taxes of the kingpin of the drug gang. I think that would be closer to the borderline of what you're talking about, Judge Srinivasan. This is a case where the entire purpose of this business was to file false tax returns. They did it for clients, and Sherry did it for herself. And LaDonna, after Sherry taught her how to in 2006, did it for herself.
So you can argue what she did independently was not part of the business. That's all I'm getting.
Is there no foreseeability requirement?
I disagree. I think that it is part of the business because she's preparing her own return, sitting at the computer while she's preparing everyone else's returns.
She goes up into another room and prepares it. The business is to prepare these returns for clients.
Sure.
Sherry's not a client. She's an owner of the business. I just wonder. Yeah. Okay.
I think if we're talking about restitution and we're dealing with what is the minimum acceptable nexus under the MVRA for restitution, which generally tracks relevant conduct, whereas under Huey, restitution is more limited. Once your restitution calculation gets closer to relevant conduct, I think this is well within the relevant conduct concept. I understand it's restitution. Because this is a business, this is a conspiracy whose purpose is to get money from the government by defrauding the government by filing false tax returns. And this is a species of that. I agree it would be a a harder case if it were a drug gang or something like that. And again, I don't think that this particular version of the argument is, at least it's not something that I understood the defense to be making. I think it's a stronger argument than what they're making. I think ultimately it fails because of the MVRA and the statutory provision of how restitution works when you're dealing with a scheme or conspiracy or a pattern. To address the, if I might, the Brady issue, I think the problem with the Sherry Davis would have a much stronger case here if the theory of the government's case, or if what actually happened was she was an absentee owner, that she was off at Las Vegas, not just when the search was executed, but you know, while all this criminal conduct was going on, and if LaDonna was there for the whole time period of the conspiracy. Because then you would have more of a type of case where it, you know, you have an underling who's saying, well, yeah, I didn't really do it, you know, pointing up to my boss, who's the bad guy. And then, you know, the boss says, well, no, it wasn't me at all. This underling is running the side fraudulent tax preparation business, and I was off in Las Vegas, and I have no idea what's going on. That's not this case. Every witness who testified in the chart on pages 12 and 13 of our brief identified Sherry Davis as being there when they had their return prepared, at least one of the years, usually most or all of the years. Sherry Davis was physically present in her house preparing these witnesses' tax returns. And the conspiracy continues for 2 years after LaDonna Davis, the potential purported mastermind, or at least person with the wherewithal to commit a tax fraud scheme, leaves the conspiracy. So that's, you know, that is this case. The conspiracy kept going just fine without LaDonna Davis there. And Sherry Davis was physically present. This is not a case where we're trying to, you know, get someone who's not around on the hook based on accomplice testimony. I also think it's wrong that Professor Curlin is wrong when he argues that without LaDonna, the sort of scheme goes away because then there's no conspirator. In other words, if there's no Andre, if Andre gets acquitted and he's not in the conspiracy, and LaDonna's not in, there's no conspiracy at all. I think that's the wrong way to look at the evidence. What we have is a criminal enterprise that's chugging along nicely, and then a potential purported key player, LaDonna, leaves, and the criminal enterprise keeps moving along. That fact is circumstantial, very strong circumstantial evidence that she wasn't really a key player at all, and that in the time period before she was there, the criminal enterprise basically was functioning the same way. So you can't just separate the two, you know, it's not like they're two separate conspiracies here. It's similar to, you know, someone walks out of a department store and the alarm goes off. If they run, well, that's indicative of guilt. And if they come back and say, oops, sorry, you know, I don't know, I had this in my bag, like that's indicative that maybe they innocently walked out. The fact that LaDonna leaves and the conspiracy keeps going is evidence of the conspiracy's existence, not just after LaDonna left, but before LaDonna left. So I think that's my response to that particular aspect of the argument.
It also predated her arrival, right?
The conspiracy as charged did not predate her arrival because she was started living with Sherry Davis in 2004. The charged conspiracy begins in 2006. So she's already living there when it starts.
Her false returns filed before she arrives.
Well, arrived. I mean, she's living in the house. Okay,
before she takes any active part in
I'm not sure that's correct because I think she was involved as early as 2006, and that's the beginning of the conspiracy time period. I could be wrong about that. I don't know that okay. The defense has made an issue of it. I do think that, I mean, she's physically present in the house. She admits to, or she testifies, she stated, and this is the Brady issue, she stated that Sherry prepared her 2006 return, taught her how to do it falsely, and then thereafter for 7, 8, 9, 10, she did it herself, based on what Sherry taught her to do. So we have her, at the very least, in 2007, preparing false tax returns, and I believe in our chart we have her for the 2006 tax year, which would have been early 2007, preparing false tax returns. So I think she's there from the beginning, and then it's Andre. She leaves, and Andre comes at roughly the same time in 2011. Andre comes back from college around the time she leaves and starts at least negotiating with the government, ultimately leading to her cooperation agreement and plea. I think that just to recap our Brady argument, the defense, I think, is not emphasizing the giglio, that is Brady impeachment side of the argument, correctly, because five returns versus thousands that she testified to filing is not a significant difference in terms of how untrustworthy this particular person is. The exculpatory prong of the argument, again, just isn't consistent with the record. It doesn't make sense in this case because the conspiracy kept going after she left, because she was clearly not a mastermind, because primarily those two, but this is not a case where, you know, she was the key player. With respect to Andre's sentencing arguments, and I'm happy to address anything particular that the court wants me to, but I think the idea that a signature by itself is meaningless, first of all, is not true. A signature is circumstantial evidence that a particular person signed something. That's just common sense. But a number of times my colleague was up here arguing that, you know, the eFIN application alone is useless, I think she said. The electronic signature alone is useless. Well, this is not a case where we're relying on just one thing. This is a circumstantial case where we're relying on the fact that Andre Davis has his name as the electronic signature on the 2012 Jay Cox return. Jay Cox testified, notwithstanding the defense arguments, that Andre prepared his return. And certainly, at the very least, the young man who worked there prepared his return.
Is there any evidence of another young man?
There was one witness, Mario Little, mentions an Adam Russell, who was typing in numbers into a computer, according to Mr. Little, that Andre Davis told him to. That's the only mention of any other man who even appeared to work there. And it's sort of a stray part of the record.
The answer to the judge's question is yes.
I'm sorry, maybe I thought it was an open-ended question, not a yes-no question.
You said, is there any evidence of another young man?
That's another man. Is he young? Yeah.
There was another young man who, according to one witness, was there, Adam Russell.
And he was described as being young?
He was young. And he also didn't, that's not in the record, I don't think. Nope, as a factual matter, he was young. He also didn't work there. But there is a stray reference in the record to a young man not working there, but playing with the computer, basically putting in the numbers that Andre Davis told him to. And I think the record also says he was a family friend. Now, what's telling here is that this is not an argument. This is an argument that was available to the defense at trial. It's not an argument they made to the jury. This is not a new argument. The argument the defense counsel who sat through the trial made was, you can't believe Jay Cox because he's lying, because he's guilty too, he just wants immunity, he's afraid of the government, and he's lying. That's the argument they made at closing. There was no Adam Russell theory made at closing, and it's an argument that was perfectly available to them. The reason they didn't make it is because there's scant support for it, and it would have been rejected for not making any sense. So I think the defense made the best arguments they had available to them at trial, and they won some of them. On Andre's counts, they won two of the three of the false return counts, and they lost one of them. And that's exactly, what juries are supposed to be doing, is listening to everyone and seeing them and sorting, guilty counts from innocent ones.
So two questions you heard me ask about count 19 in light of count 15, and also the closing argument as to the 2 points, LaDonna statement.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Count 19 and 15.
Yeah.
I believe that was your first question, so I'm going to rack my brain a little bit.
Sufficiency of the evidence. So, all right, and the district court granted the motion to dismiss count 15, saying it wasn't enough to have evidence that somebody was sitting at a computer.
Right.
Then as to count 19, the argument is made that there's no evidence, again, it's a temporal point, that the figures were entered by Andre or that he knew that the figures entered were false.
Right. That's incorrect. The evidence, Thomas J. Cox testified that Andre prepared his return and Sherry came by to finish it up or finalize it.
No, but what I'm trying to get at is the argument is that J. Cox on, cross-examination, withdrew his identification of Andre, said if he bumped into him in the street, he wouldn't know who he was. So he referred to a young man. So the question is, if it's the young man or if it's Sherry, is it enough to convict Andre of the count 19 charge?
I think there are two different components. There are two different potential defense arguments in your question, Your Honor. The first is Andre versus some young man. And at the very least, defense counsel concedes that Mr. Jaycox did identify a young man. He also identified Andre Davis. They think he repudiated that. We think his testimony is inconsistent. The record can speak for itself on that. But
let me just say, suppose the court takes his cross-examination testimony, which was not just one question, one answer, as what the evidence was in terms of the government meeting its burden of proof. Then what do you have?
The difference between count 15 and count 19 is not anything about a young man or the sufficiency of the identification.
It's the knowledge issue.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's an actus reus issue.
All right, who did it?
Right.
And the question is, what's the evidence to show Andre did it?
The evidence is, I don't think that's in dispute. The evidence is that the young man prepared the return.
Yes.
Their issue is one of identification. But if Your Honor, if I can explain that count 15 is a very different issue than what we have in count 19.
I just gave it as an example of the district court understanding it wouldn't be enough to just say the guy was sitting at the computer entering numbers, all right?
And that was an actus reus holding. What the district court said with count 15 was the mere fact that Andre was there,
right,
and his name did appear on the return,
right,
which is probably why Sherry was acquitted of the same count. The district court then ruled 29's Andre because the witness's testimony was not that Andre did anything. He was just there. Mr. Jaycox's testimony was that Andre and or the young man prepared his return. That's an actus reus issue. The defense argument is maybe it was Andre, maybe it was somebody else.
But if the evidence is somebody prepared my return, it may have been the defendant or it may have been someone else. And then on cross-examination, I say, even though I earlier testified that it was the defendant and I was sitting, across from him, but I wouldn't know him if I saw him in the street.
I think that
is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt? That's what I'm trying to get you to focus on. And
yes.
You want to skirt around it, I know.
Because the identification is simply one piece of evidence. It's a brick in the wall of the evidence against Andre. So, yes, it is.
And what do you think your burden is?
Beyond a reasonable doubt. Oh, here?
Yeah, I mean, counsel, that's too facile by.
I mean, the burden below is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The burden here is Jackson v. Virginia.
For sufficiency of the evidence, what did the government have to show for count 19? And I thought it was, and maybe I'm wrong, that it had to have evidence from what a reasonable jury could find that Andre entered the false numbers or approved the return that had the false numbers, knowing they were false.
Yes, that's right. And the evidence and the evidence was that the young man who prepared, let's just take the defense theory for a second. The evidence was that the young man who prepared Mr. Jaycox's return prepared it, sat at a table with him, and entered numbers for the 2012 year, and then Sherry came by to look it over or finalize it. And then it was signed and filed.
So how could the jury find, based on the evidence before it, that Andre is the one who entered the false numbers as opposed to Sherry? That's all I'm trying to understand.
And I apologize, Your Honor, for being dense.
Because Sherry comes over, finalizes the return, and we're not clear, on the timing, et cetera. That's all I'm trying to understand.
Oh, I see, Your Honor. And I apologize for not getting your point earlier. We charged them with, because we believed, that they both filed a false return.
What the government believes isn't good enough.
No,
I
understand. We had to prove it. The jury acquitted Sherry on Jaycox's return, presumably because her name wasn't on it.
No. You can't speculate as to what the jury found. The question is, what was your evidence that Andre either entered the false numbers or knew they were false and approved the return? That's all I'm asking. Right.
Andre knowingly joined a criminal organization that did nothing but file false tax returns all day for years. He was warned about it by LaDonna Davis and was dismissive of it and said, it's not a big deal, it's just going to go away, in reference to the criminal investigation. He helped his mother, who had been kicked out of the EFIN, electronic filing program by the IRS a few months earlier. He used his name to sign her up for the electronic filing program again, which, contrary, I think, to the defense argument, would itself be fraud because it would fall within the client conspiracy charge, and then begins preparing returns with her and working in the business.
Most of what you just said there has to do with the conspiracy conviction.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought what Judge Rogers was asking about was the filing of the false return for the 2012.
I thought
that the evidence is Jay Cox's testimony.
Yes.
So it depends on how you characterize his testimony. And if his testimony to the effect that he prepared my return is enough, it's enough. If it's not, it's not.
I agree. And then what I'm attempting to respond to Judge Rogers' question is saying that's not all we have. Because to the extent that there is ambiguity in Thomas J. Cox's question testimony, it has to be evaluated in light of the overall conspiracy.
Right.
Obviously, being involved in a criminal conspiracy whose goal is to file false tax returns makes it more likely on any given point in time, on any given day, that you knowingly filed a false tax return.
I think the problem with the plus part, I'm not saying the if you take out the plus part, it's not enough, but it seems to me one problem with the plus part is, as to this count, one of them did it. That's what the jury thought.
Right.
So then the question becomes which. And I think Andre's argument is that wasn't me.
Right.
I didn't have anything to do with it. If it's false, Sherry was the one who did it. So the fact that they're both involved in a conspiracy together, which is all the more stuff, doesn't really help you as to that. Because, yeah, they're both involved in the conspiracy. But as to this count, with respect to the false 2012 tax return for Jay Cox, it's just a dispute about which one of them is the one that's responsible for the falsity.
I'm not sure it's that mutual exclusive. I think the jury appears to have believed it was, based on what we see from the convictions. But two people can prepare a false tax return knowingly.
Sure.
I think in this case, it was a who did it, and it was to the jury to decide who did it, and the jury decided that Andre did it based on listening to Thomas J. Cox testify for a day.
So it comes down to Jay Cox's testimony.
And it comes down to Jay Cox's testimony, as did the identity and the actus reus. I think that because Judge Rogers was asking more generally about knowledge, I think the conspiracy and the existence, the proved existence of the conspiracy, is very good evidence of knowledge. And I think my opposing counsel said something at the beginning, agreeing with that you know, the conspiracy charge and the false return charge are going to, in other words, if there's a false return, there's going to be conspiracy because the knowledge elements overlap for those. The question here is the specific actus reus for this tax return, and that was based on Thomas J. Cox's testimony, as Judge Srinivasan pointed out. But I think that's our case on Mr. Davis.
J. Cox's testimony that he sat down with the young man, went through this process, but he wouldn't know Andre if he bumped into him. It seemed to suggest that it was someone other than Andre.
And I think I think the defense is overreading that line. You wouldn't know him if you bumped into him in the street. There are plenty of people that I could say that I've met or interacted with that I might not recognize if I bumped into them on the street. They're just different standards. He didn't say, I don't remember who it was. He didn't say, I have, no idea what the guy looks like. He said he wouldn't recognize him if I bumped into him in the street. That's true for professors I've had in law school. I can say I had this professor in law school. I wouldn't necessarily know him if I bumped him into the street. I wouldn't recognize him right away. He didn't know him well. The testimony from Jay Cox was he knew Sherry, and he had seen Andre, and then he identified Andre. And when he was cross-examined about it, in the testimony that the defense points to in their opening brief, they point to the line of saying, based on the name and the return, and then he gets interrupted. And then the next page is the part we quote in our brief where he says, what I'm saying is, I'm not sure it's 2012. I need to see the name on the return to know which year Andre prepared my return. So I think that Andre's testimony Jay Cox's testimony is more, at least, certain than the defense suggests. At the very least, it's inconsistent, and the jury watched this gentleman testify for the better part of a day and convicted Andre on this count when it acquitted him on two other counts. In sum, there are no further questions, Your Honor. We think the defendants in this case were properly convicted and sentenced, and we ask this court to affirm.
Thank you.
Court would indulge me. I do have quite a few things I want to touch on. As to the sufficiency, to be clear, an e-signature, I just want to be clear about this. It's just the entry of a prepare ID number. That's all it is. And regarding the framing issue, the idea that Sherry, that it would be unlikely that Sherry would leave his name on there, I just want to say that she obviously wasn't worried about having her name all over these things, and LaDonna said that Sherry didn't switch out the preparer ID when she went in and made entries, as she did here. That's the important thing I don't think the government mentioned. It's not just that she came in and finalized it, but she actually put information in. The government agrees that it was fine for Jaycox to bring in these AMVET receipts, so there's no inference from that that it would give Andre any intent. Saying the young man went over the return is not enough, given the timing. I think we talked about that. As far as him saying that the defense argument was different below, that's, of course, obviously completely irrelevant to what the sufficiency, whether the evidence was sufficient. This doesn't have anything to do with it. The strategy that was chosen when you're in a joint trial, this doesn't have anything to do with anything. And also, the withdrawal of the ID was not on cross. It was actually on redirect. It's not as if he was tricked into somehow, like, backing down. The government, it maybe should have become obvious on cross, but it didn't. And then the government elicited on redirect that, you know, really, it was a young man, and you don't really recognize the defendant. So I want to make that point. And I want to also be clear that the government can't say that, you know, the Jaycox stuff makes the conspiracy and the conspiracy makes the Jaycox stuff. I mean, there's no other evidence of conspiracy. He cannot be convicted of conspiracy if he has no connection to any false or knowledge of any false returns. I hope I'm clear about that. Regarding the closing errors, the error, you can't say that the error must not be plain if defense counsel didn't notice it, because that's always the case, obviously. All I can say is it's brief, and it was obviously false and should have been caught. And the case was hanging by a thread if it was sufficient. The sentencing, I'd like to say that about Huey, I think the government's totally misunderstanding this relevant conduct thing. I really want to clear that up, because to the extent this 3663 saying relevant conduct, 4443 is not relevant conduct of the conspiracy, even to Sherry. Sherry's held responsible for that because of her substantive counts. The conspiracy does not cover, count 12 does not cover Sherry's conduct. Sherry's conduct counts 34 through 36 or whatever. So it's not even relevant conduct for Sherry in the conspiracy, and it could only be relevant conduct for Mr. Even if it was, it could only be relevant conduct for Mr. Davis if it was within the scope of his agreement within the conspiracy and foreseeable to him. But it's not even relevant conduct for Sherry. So what 3663 is really saying, 3663 is about a situation where someone pleads to one count of mail fraud and there's a scheme, and all the other victims who weren't in that count are not getting any money back. And so they said if there's a scheme, if it has as an element a scheme, then and what it says is, the government quotes it, that a victim is defined as, so the defining victim says defined as someone who is harmed as a result of the defendant's criminal conduct. So it's just really inapplicable here. Because the United States, we already know the United States is a victim, and this conduct that was done by Sherry was not the defendant's conduct. So there's no way the 4443, which was fully preserved, can possibly be affirmed. The two preparer pattern people that were very clearly challenged by defense counsel below, Williams and Deborah Johnson, the point of that is that the preparer pattern information was inconsistent with what the agent said. The judge did not know this out-of-record information that the counsel is bringing out now and saying this was an earlier draft.
I asked him about that, and he said if I read the sentencing hearing completely, I will see this is all explained to the district court.
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
As I understood the counsel's response to my question, all of this was explained to the district court at the sentencing hearing, and I would see that if I read the complete sentencing hearing transcript.
Well, I don't think it was explained that it had actually been superseded, by...
Well, did the district court understand that? I thought that was the thrust of Judge...
I did not see that in
Ginsburg's
the sentencing. That does not sound right to me.
So you think the district court was proceeding on the basis of this inadvertently filed document?
I think he kept asking, what does this mean, what does this mean, and the government didn't tell him. And then in the end, he just said, I'm going to go with the agent's testimony. And, if that document hadn't been there, the agent's testimony would have been sort of a black box. We wouldn't really understand how the agent got to his numbers, but he would have said, trust me, I asked about the credit, I asked, we know what the number is, and we did it, and this is what we got, and that would probably be okay.
No, but when you heard counsel. He said that what the district court finally had before it was a statement based on the interviews, the reports, the memorandum on these interviews and the trial testimony.
Well, but the two people we're challenging, they don't, it says prepare a pattern, and I guess I didn't make this point. I just would like to say that the prepare a pattern, it doesn't make any sense because you can't solve, you can't figure out.
So prepare a pattern is still on the final document?
No.
That's my point.
Yeah. It's not, but the judge doesn't understand. My reading of the transcript is that it's not clarified for the judge. It's not cleared up. And unless the prepare pattern is we always triple the real donations or we always add a zero to the real donations, it makes no sense to say that you could possibly figure out what the credit is. So it just, and I think Naeem did not try to explain how that was consistent at all. We would ask the court to vacate both counts of Mr. Davis's conviction, dismiss the case, and in the alternate order a new trial, and in the alternative grant him a resentencing as to both the loss, with both loss and the restitution to be no greater than the loss that he was attributed to, minus Sherry's personal return and minus Deborah Johnson and Thomas Williams' loss. Thank you.
Your Honors, very briefly, the first thing with respect to the sentencing and the above $550,000, in light of the government's concession, which I think they actually also conceded in their brief, so that wasn't new, Sherry needs a resentencing anyway, because even assuming, a point that I'm not going to concede right now, that the proper calculation, because I believe enough stuff is before the court, they might deal with some other issues as well, but even with respect to the government's concession, the total amount of loss, even if it's above $550,000, affects the judge's sentencing. Judge Hogan already departed in the original sentencing for a variety of other factors, but if the amount of loss comes down, if the D.C. stuff is taken out, at minimum, there needs to be a remand for resentencing with the recognition, I would assume, that, one, the lower number Judge Hogan can depart if he wants to. The other thing is that if it turns out with respect to some other factors, which has been argued in the brief, if the number comes down either more issues with respect to prepare a pattern, I don't think the government is going to, I don't want to assume the government's going to argue, but if the calculation at a resentencing goes below $550,000, I don't believe that Judge Hogan is going to enter an illegal sentence based on some purported waiver as to how the issues were preserved below. But in any event, at a minimum, knocking out the D.C. calculation numbers drops it substantially, and even if it is above $550,000, that would still give the grounds for a new resentencing and the ability for Judge Hogan to take everything into account.
And so this is the departure argument?
No, I'm simply saying that with regard to, if it turns out, and I'm not conceding this, but if it turns out that even with the government's concession that the amount is still above $550,000, that's still several hundred thousand dollars below what the original amount of loss was in the first thing. And that is.
But why does this matter? If you're still in the same tranche for the base offense.
Well, no, I was simply just pointing out that I believe that Judge Hogan, for a variety of other reasons, departed downward. A lower number, even within that range, $550,000 to $1.4 million or something like that. That it's judges could still, the trial judge might still feel that with that lower number.
If it's 551, might come to, okay.
The other point that I just want to make very briefly has to do with some of the statements that the government made concerning the scope of the conspiracy, and then with this Adam Russell, the one line in the transcript. The government, in closing, argues this. And this is on page 1303 in the joint appendix. And the elements for conspiracy in an abridged fashion are the defendant agreed with at least one other person to defraud the United States. This defendant, Sherry Davis, agreed first with LaDonna Davis and then her son after LaDonna pled guilty. Sherry Davis and LaDonna Davis agreed, and then Sherry Davis and her son agreed. And that's on 1303 and 1304 in the joint transcript. Just so there is no misunderstanding, and I'm not 100% sure that's what the government was arguing, but when I was listening to the government's argument, any suggestion that the record demonstrates that there was another co-conspirator, known or unknown, is patently not supported by the record, and was not the way the government argued the case. So, with respect to the way that the government tried to sort of reconfigure conspiracy law, the conspiracy is a specific charge that deals with manner and means that deal with false Schedule Cs and false charitable contributions. The way the government argued it here was that, well, it's conspiracy to defraud the government, filing fake information all over the place and ripping off the government. That isn't the charge. So when the court is evaluating the evidence with respect to if Andre is dropped out for legal insufficiency, then there is no conspiracy after LaDonna leaves the conspiracy as a matter of law. And the point that I was making, or I tried to make, both in the brief and in my initial argument, the government sort of changed. This isn't a legal sufficiency argument. We all know that. The point is that with respect to that first half of the conspiracy, the underlying attack on LaDonna's credibility and the additional possibility that the statement that LaDonna prepared her original 2006 return is a controverted issue. The government's representation that it isn't is not the case. If that could have come in as substantive evidence based on the Brady violation, that in addition to the additional erosion of her plain old credibility, hits the Brady standard and the standard set forth in Pasha that the confidence in the conspiracy verdict is gone. Now, what does that leave? It might leave, and I'm not suggesting that it does, it might leave a bunch of independent 7206 charges against Sherry and perhaps against, but that is a whole different ballgame, and on that particular ground, the court would then have to look to, is the erosion of the conspiracy charge so sufficient, so comprehensive, that it creates a situation where, well, you know what, Sherry might have testified, and we do not have confidence in any of the verdicts. And I think if the court, if the court gets to the point where the conspiracy verdict is in question, and the decision is made that under Brady that has to go, the court then also really needs to, as a practical matter, step back and say, doesn't that also sort of unravel everything? And the fact remains, and the government didn't argue otherwise or didn't contend the point, this case could not go forward without LaDonna's cooperation. And so if LaDonna's credibility and her ability to be further eroded with respect to substantive evidence that could have come in that indicated that she did file a 2006 tax return, she created the entirely independent fraud scheme with regard to dependents. If the conspiracy charge is eroded, I think the court has to look at Pasha and say, you know what, that probably does raise a sufficient a question concerning the integrity of the verdict on all counts. Your Honors, thank you very much. We want to
thank you,
over.
And thank
that.
You, Professor, on behalf of the court for your assistance in this appeal.
Thank you very much. It's always an honor to accept the appointments. Thank you very much.
We will take a brief recess.